This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined by Caitlin Doty. She's coming up to Bismarck for the Game Changer Ideas Festival this weekend, and Ashley Thornburg and I have found a very provocative person to talk to.
Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here. I'm also so happy to be coming to Bismarck. I'm ready.
And, of course, this year's theme of the Game Changer Ideas Festival is focusing on how we live and how we die. And you are a mortician and a self-professed rabble-rouser in the funeral industry. So let's just set us up with what you mean by rabble-rouser.
Yeah, I'm the how to die section of the festival, I think. What I mean by rabble-rouser, and that's sort of a funny word, but what I mean is that I have different views about the funeral industry than a lot of your typical morticians might. At my funeral home in Los Angeles, we don't offer embalming, which is the chemical preservation of a dead body. We don't offer the heavy caskets, metal caskets, and heavy vaults that most funeral homes or cemeteries do require. So we have a much more natural, simple, less expensive take on what funerals can be.
And why did you go this direction?
You know, it started in the funeral industry when I was 22 years old. I was a crematory operator, which means I was the one who was in there cremating the bodies day to day. And I just saw firsthand a lot of the excesses of the funeral industry and the fact that the family wasn't involved very often in what was happening behind the scenes. It was just the funeral directors, and they were the experts, and the families were kept away outside the closed room in the back. And that seemed wrong to me. It seemed like I shouldn't be the only one there before the cremation or before the burial. And that really changed my perspective, and that's really what I've been campaigning for ever since.
And when you have, like you said, the business people who are in charge of doing this and not the family, you lose a lot of the ritual that used to go with death. It doesn't mean death wasn't difficult, but it means that there was a process. So I just want to talk about the importance of whatever someone's process is with death. Why is having a ritual important?
Oh, what a great question. That's a perfect question. You don't have 3 hours for me to talk about this, but I think ritual is so important because we have these important transitions in our life. We have birth, we have death, we have weddings, we have funerals. These are important transitions that we're losing in a lot of ways and not honoring. And in many ways, that's because we're becoming more secular as a culture. And for some people, that's fantastic, and they don't need religion. But I think that we still need ritual. Death is a change. You go from knowing dad and having dad in your life to dad is just poof, gone. And if you don't honor or engage in that in some way, if you just send him to be cremated and don't see him until they mail you a box of urn or, you know, his ashes in an urn 3 weeks later, how have you transitioned? How has your life changed? How have you grappled with that? And so that's why I think some sort of ritual, even if what is currently happening in the funeral industry doesn't resonate with you, doesn't feel great, you need to have something. And that's what I'm trying to encourage people to reengage with and bring back.
Well, you talked about being the person in the crematory when that was taking place. And a lot of burials are that old-fashioned traditional one with the vault and the casket and the cemetery and the flowers and all. So there is that kind of ritual built in. But how did we get to that place? Because that's sort of a 20th century idea, isn't it?
It is, yeah. We call it traditional burial or conventional burial, but it's not really all that traditional. It really is a 20th century design for burial. Prior to the 20th century, every burial was just a simple burial. It was literally a shallow hole dug in the earth and a shrouded body or a lightly wooden casketed body put directly into the earth. And the family was there digging the grave and putting the dirt on top and crying, and they were going through something.
That's a ritual, and yeah.
It's a ritual, yeah. Going back to that, it's the ritual you possibly need or possibly could work for you. And the feedback that I hear from so many people about how burials specifically are done in the 20th and 21st century is that they show up at the cemetery and the grave is already dug and mom is sitting in a casket next to the grave and the astroturf is covering the dirt. And because of liability in the cemetery, they don't even lower the casket into the grave while the family is there. The family kind of walks up while the casket's there, looks around, and then walks away. And there's, you know, where is the ritual in that? Where is something to do? Where is something to feel in that scenario?
Well, am I being, you know, dark here when I think of how did all this get to be? Because there's a casket that costs money. There's a cemetery that costs money. There's a vault that costs money. Flowers. There's all of this stuff. How did we get marketed up to this?
Well, again, we don't have an hour, but I this is the most fascinating history to me, and it's really the history of the early 20th century. And there's a lot to unpack there, but really it was a group of men who realized that they could make money through the funeral service because, again, the family was entirely in charge of everything prior to the 20th century. The body would be cared for at home, washed for at home, laid out at home. Your neighbors would make the casket. You'd maybe, if you spent money, you'd maybe rent a carriage to take the casket down to the grave. And that was all that you spent money for. And there were no professionals involved. But after the American Civil War, when embalming first rose up in America to transfer the soldiers from the South back to the North, those same embalmers realized they could go from city to city selling embalming fluid, selling this new method of preservation, selling the idea of funeral homes, and that's where it came out of. And slowly the family and women got pushed out of taking care of the dead and of these funerals. And I'm not saying that every person in the funeral industry now is some evil man with ideas to take all your money. There are a lot of incredible, kind people in the funeral industry. But families should just know that there is another history and that there is another way to be involved and to take care of the dead if that's something they are interested in.
What does, I mean, this focus on marketing and capitalism, or even just making it an easier way to deal with the death, is sort of this concept of the, we call it a celebration of life now sometimes instead of a funeral. What do you think that the 20th and 21st century practices of death say about how we live?
I think there was this time in the early 20th century where people became more interested in outsourcing difficult things. So keep in mind, in the early 20th century, I said people used to die in the home. They died in the home. They took care of the body in the home. There were no big hospitals. You slaughtered all your animals in the home or on your farm. And now all of that death is outsourced. We die in hospitals. We'd like to die at home, but primarily statistics show we die in hospitals. We aren't waked or celebrated in the home. We're taken to a funeral home. All of our meat is slaughtered in these, you know, faraway places that with high walls that we never see. So all of this death that used to inform our lives and be a part of our lives is now completely gone. We don't see it happen. We don't see it taken care of. And I think that that cannot help but have a profound impact on our lives, and especially now that we live in such a technology-driven world where we're even further away from the realities and the physical realities of death and life. There's no way that death can't be much more of an abstract, faraway concept than it was 100 years ago.
Caitlin Doty is coming to Bismarck for the Game Changer Ideas Festival on Saturday. She speaks at 4:15 in the afternoon. The topic of her speech is Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory. This is, of course, the Game Changer Ideas Festival, and you can find out more at GameChangerND.com.
And we will have more of our conversation with Caitlin coming up here, but we are going to take a moment now to let you know about how you can support programming like this. And it starts with a phone call. 1-800-359-4145 is the number to call to invest in Prairie Public. You can also click and join at prairiepublic.org or send a text message to 484848, just a one-word text message, and that word is support. And think about this, something like the Game Changer Ideas Festival, they are bringing in some of the country's most brilliant minds on any given topic. And you know what? They charge for that. And it's, you know, it's, let's just say it's not a $5 ticket to go to something like Game Changer.
It's an all-day event.
And they are right to charge that because they did an enormous amount of work and research and recruiting this talent to bring that in. And that's what you're paying for when you're going to something like the Game Changer Ideas Festival. And that's what you're paying for when you invest in Prairie Public. The only real difference is that we're just saying what you can afford, and they have a set level. And we could have a set level, but that's just not how we do things. And you get to decide what this service is worth to you. And the number to call to let us know is 1-800-359-4145, or click and join online at prairiepublic.org, or text the word support to 484848 if you love conversations that come to us courtesy of Humanities North Dakota, like this thoughtful discussion about how we do death and what that means about how we live.
You know, I suspect most of the listeners out there, like us, to be honest with you, you know, are less than excited about these sort of membership drives. We're excited that we might be getting some revenue, obviously. I don't want to downplay that. But, you know, you look at it as an interruption to your programming, and in a way we do too. But I'm thinking about this right now, and I'm thinking, well, this is a show called Main Street, and the people listening to it are listening to Main Street. So this is our opportunity to actually talk to our audience about why we need your support. Main Street would not be here without members' support of Prairie Public. It's that simple. Morning Edition wouldn't be here. All Things Considered wouldn't be here. Wait, don't tell me. You know, name the show. It wouldn't be here. Members make it possible. So that's why we want to ask you, if you are a listener, if you've ever thought about being a member, pick up that phone. Give us a call at 800-359-4145 and talk with us. Tell us about what you like about Main Street, what you don't like about Main Street. But we want to have the conversation because you are our audience. And if you're listening right now, there has to be a reason. Caitlin Doty's pretty interesting to listen to, I think.
Oh, she's fascinating.
That's provocative stuff. And it's not something you're likely to hear just about anywhere else unless you go searching on the internet. She's there. She's got YouTube videos and that kind of thing. This show is designed for you. You're the Main Street audience. So we're asking you to support Main Street. Give us a call. 1-800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org, or you can text the word support to 484848. For those of you who have, thank you.
Because it is supporting everything that you hear on Prairie Public. And now let's go back to some of that hearing. Let's get back to our conversation with Caitlin.
Caitlin, you started an organization you call a Death Acceptance Collective, the Order of the Good Death. What is that?
That's a good question. What it is, so it started in 2011, and back then I was really just looking for other people who shared these same ideas that I have and who were trying to be open about death, have these open conversations about death with the public and amongst themselves. And what it turned into is academics and funeral practitioners, medical examiners, writers, artists, just people who are in some kind of death profession and are anxious to speak about what they do publicly. And over time, we threw out the word death positivity, or the phrase death positivity, to describe what we do, meaning that it's completely okay and acceptable to normalize death and have open, honest conversations about death, and to try and look at some of the practices we currently engage in and what might make it better for families. And that is how we have developed, and we now have members all over the world.
Well, do you have meetings? Do you have a newsletter? What does the collective do?
We have a very harsh initiation ceremony. There's writing back, drinking from ancient goblets. We do a lot of promotion and work and resources online. And if you're interested in anything we talk about today, including green burials or home funerals or being involved in the funeral industry, Order of the Good Death. .com has a great resource section, but our big meetings are something called death salons. And the death salon is based on the 18th century salon, which is an exchange of ideas and experts coming together to have these conversations. So we have death salons where we meet up in person.
Well, let's talk about laws, because some of the things that you are talking about, how we used to do death, some of them aren't even allowed anymore. So what are some of the laws that you wish could be a little bit different? You talk about even in your book when your grandmother passed, the funeral director told your mother that keeping the body longer than 2 hours was against the law. And that's not even true.
Right. I think it's not so much laws that need to change, but public awareness of what people's rights actually are.
Okay.
So people still have a lot of rights when it comes to their dead. For example, if your mom dies at home on hospice and you decide you're going to call the funeral home and let them know that she died, but you just want to sit with the body in the home for a day, for 2 days, however long is comfortable for you, that is 100% your right to do so. It's very safe to be with the dead body and just keep them at home and have a nice wake at home, and it's completely legal to do that. Another thing is a natural burial. We think that it's the law to dig a hole 7 feet in the ground and put the big concrete vault in and put the big heavy casket in, and if you want that, of course that's available to you. But if you want a much simpler burial without the vault and the casket, just in the earth and allowed to go directly back into the earth, that is also completely legal. It's the cemetery that decides whether or not that's allowed. And a lot of cemeteries don't like to do it because it makes it harder for them to landscape. It makes it harder for their big mowers to go over the grass when they don't have a big vault under there supporting the earth. But it's completely legal. So these things that I'm talking about aren't pie in the sky, return to 19th century weirdo ideas. These are available to you right now, and a lot of people are taking advantage of these ideas and doing them. You just need to know your rights as a consumer and as a griever.
What are the best ways to advocate for yourself? Is it best in an ideal situation to have this all pre-planned, no questions asked?
It is. And people, sometimes I get, so I'm with the Order of the Good Death. My Twitter handle is The Good Death. I get some pushback sometimes for using the term The Good Death, because people say, oh, well, what about bad deaths? Not everyone dies this beautiful, amazing death. What about them? And I think that is valid. But what I say in response to that is that the good death, especially in the 21st century, does not just happen. You are not going to stumble in to the perfect hospice and a beautiful home funeral and a natural burial on your property, you know, at the top of the hill overlooking the tree. You know, you're not going to stumble into that. It's not just going to come together.
Well, that brings up something that Ashley was referring to there. I mean, if your mother dies at home and you're with the body for a day or two and she wanted to be buried in the backyard by the rose bush, you can't do that, can you?
Well, it depends on where you live. I am not – each county is completely different, so I couldn't tell you what it's like in Bismarck or in Fargo. But I feel like you probably have a better shot there than you do someplace like Los Angeles. So really it's about just calling the county and seeing if they do allow property burials. We don't here in L.A. We don't here in California. Really, Michael Jackson wanted to be buried at Neverland Ranch when he died, and they wouldn't let him no matter what. So, you know, see, that's a good example. Even if you plan for the perfect burial or perfect funeral, it might not happen. But if you don't plan at all, you're not going to come anywhere near what you're looking for.
I noticed, so you have a YouTube series, it's called Ask a Mortician, and episode one to this day has about 39,000 views. Several other of your episodes have more than a million views. When did you kind of first realize that you'd really hit on something that we were missing as a society?
Well, I think the first episode might just be a throwaway thing that I never released, and that's why the views are so low. But the actual first episode got 80,000 views, I think, on the first day, just because it got picked up by some news organization. So I was really at a point then in 2011 when I was just a new advocate and was throwing things out and seeing what would stick and seeing what people liked. And that took off immediately, and it was just simple questions. It was just me in front of my laptop camera saying, what is rigor mortis? And I heard they do this during a cremation. And what I found out very quickly is that so many people are so confused about what goes on behind the scenes in a funeral home, about what their rights are, about what happens to a dead body after death, but they're fascinated by it. They want to know, but nobody is telling them in a way that's accessible and friendly and pulls no punches. And that's what I've been trying to do ever since. And people, it's evergreen. You know, each new generation is a new generation of death deniers to be spoken to and fixed and opened up to the possibilities. And just not having, it's not morbid to talk about death. It's morbid to be in denial and not talk about death.
Well, when you talk about accessible communication with these people who are watching and who are reaching out to you, humor plays such a huge role of it. As I was reading your book, I was like, oh, I'm really kind of laughing a lot at this book about a gal who's working in a crematory and what she's learning. So just the role of humor in talking about difficult things.
It is. It's, life is tragedy and comedy. Every death is tragedy and comedy wrapped up into one. And I think that you have to, it's the spoonful of sugar that helps the medicine go down. And I do think it helped normalize it. It says, okay, we're talking about a decomposing body. That's horrifying and threatening to our sense of self as a healthy, alive human. But this is science. This is history. This is fact. And it's okay to talk about it with a lighter tone, because that not only draws people in, it normalizes it. It makes it, it's not like, I don't do a video where I say, this is a decomposing body. Oh, God, you know, close up horror music in the background, because that doesn't make it safe and accessible. Humor makes it safe and accessible to talk about.
Well, I watched your YouTube video on cremation, and during the course of that, you let loose this little nugget of information, which is that the natural gas used for a typical cremation would equal about a 500-mile car trip. So you are advocating for what I think is referred to as green burial. And I did a little online research, and I found a funeral home in our area that offers options they call green burial. Let's talk a bit about that.
Yeah, wonderful. So we do a lot of cremations at my funeral home, and I'm not anti-cremation. I know that it's the least expensive, most accessible option for most families. But it's not the best environmentally. There is a ton of natural gas that goes into it, and things come out of the smokestack that aren't the best. But I understand why people choose it, and many people in my family have chosen it. But I think that I'm most excited about green burial because, again, humans have been doing this for tens of thousands of years. Muslims and Jewish people continue to do this through the 20th century. But it's really just putting your body back into the earth, a grave that's only a couple feet deep, a shrouded body, or a body in a simple wicker casket that decomposes. And I feel like I've taken from the earth for my whole life, and I want to just be able to go back and give back to the earth when I die and have my atoms, you know, go back into the universe. And that's why I personally find green burial so comforting, and why it's really coming back in a big way throughout the United States.
That's Caitlin Doty, a mortician, activist, and funeral industry rabble-rouser. We'll hear more from her. And we'll also hear from Kelly Brown. She's going to talk to us about a very cold, wet, and wintry sauerkraut day in Wishick, North Dakota. But first, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Mandan police have released more details on an officer-involved shooting that happened on Tuesday afternoon. Police say they were working with the Metro Area Narcotics Task Force, searching for a 26-year-old man. The man was wanted on a number of warrants. The man, who was not identified, was seen at the Frontier Mobile Home Park in southeast Mandan. Police stopped the car he was in, and shortly after that, a police officer fired, striking and injuring the suspect. The man was taken to a local hospital for treatment. The Bureau of Criminal Investigation is involved, and the officer was placed on administrative leave. North Dakota Agriculture Commissioner Doug Goring says he's hoping Congress will be able to get a farm bill passed by the end of the year, likely in the lame duck session following the midterm elections. However,
it gives me a little bit of anxiety because I don't know what political pressures are going to be in place going forward in the lame duck session to get it done.
Goring says if nothing happens before the first of the year, then farm law reverts to the permanent law, which was passed in 1949.
I don't see Congress letting that happen. So instead of doing an extension, I hope they get on their A game and get this thing done when they reconvene after the election.
The chairman and ranking members of the House and Senate Ag Committees continue to meet and negotiate. And former Attorney General Bob Weifold says the recreational marijuana question on next month's ballot would be a disaster. Weifold, who is also a district judge, court judge in Bismarck, says he's most concerned with the lack of regulation.
We're not voting on whether farmers can make money. We're not voting on sales tax. We're not voting on the revenue stream. We are voting on this particular measure. It is flawed. It is poorly drafted. I think even some of the people who have supported the idea say, well, you know, it is poorly drafted. They should have gone to the legislature. They should have gone to some attorney that had competence in writing these things.
Weifold of North Dakotans Against the Legalization of Marijuana debated the issue with David Owen of Legalize ND.
We have people that were unfortunately lied to by our government for a long time. In Reefer Madness and in the movies, they said that marijuana was worse than heroin. That's false. Just is. And when you have years and years and years of being lied to, eventually you start to believe it.
Owen says cities and states would benefit from sales and other taxes, even though that's not part of the ballot language. Weifold counters that there's no assurance of any tax benefit. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
From your hometown to Capitol Hill, budgets are part of our everyday lives. I'm Elsa Chang. Taxes, tariffs, trade, the choices you make this November connect to all of them. When you give every month as a sustaining member, you help us cover the economic and political news that will affect you years down the road. Here's how to support the news you'll need tomorrow, today.
1-800-359-4145 or click and join online at prairiepublic.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and we are talking with mortician and activist Caitlin Doty. Here's more of that conversation.
There are a lot of major players in the funeral industry, and I'm wondering if they treat you, I mean, do you get blowback, or do you get recognition, or do you mostly just get ignored?
It's a delightful combination of all three of those things. Speaking of being ignored, I'm speaking in Salt Lake City this year at the National Funeral Directors Association, which is the big, giant annual conference, the biggest one in the world for funeral directors. And if you had told me 3 years ago that they would be inviting me to speak, I would have, you know, called you the greatest liar in all the land. But here we are. I think that as much as some of them just don't like me and do not like these ideas, I think that they're becoming too well known and too popular to ignore. And funeral homes are getting people asking for green burial, and they're getting people asking to come in and just, you know, have a little lock of mom's hair or help, you know, dress her at the funeral home, or just these simple things that funeral directors were not interested in doing for many, many years. So I think that that the movement that I am a part of is becoming too big to ignore, and they can keep saying what they want about me online or in their private lives, but they're going to need to adapt.
You know, years ago, I was reading a popular novel by Patricia Cornwell, which referred to the body farm, and I believe that's the one she was talking about is somewhere in Tennessee or maybe North Carolina. But you actually referred to in one of your videos visiting one of these body farms and actually doing an experiment there with wood chips. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Yes. This is the new exciting future of death. So the one that she was talking about, the original one, is in Tennessee. The one that I visited was in North Carolina. And what I was there for is a colleague of mine, Katrina Spade, is working on a new system of composting dead bodies called Recompose. And the idea of that is pretty similar to green burial. It's just quickly turning the body back into earth, back into the mulch of compost. So she's doing an experiment there at that body farm, and she's also doing one now in Washington State. And what it is just seeing different using donor bodies, bodies donated to science, to see how to combine things like wood chips and alfalfa and water and the right temperature to very quickly turn the body into soil. And a lot of people, you know, some people think that's Soylent Green and absolutely the most horrifying thing they've ever heard. And then other people who maybe live in a more rural area or do composting cannot wait to have their body turn back into rich, nutrient-rich earth when they die, maybe to help grow a lemon tree or grow new things. So that's why it's so important to have all of these different options, because maybe someone is saying, no, I want my grandma in the ground, in a casket, preserved, locked up, don't let anybody touch her. And someone else is saying, my grandma wants to be turned into dirt that nourishes new life. And there are really different ends of the spectrum when it comes to death, and they all need to be available and honored.
Well, it's nice to know we have some options.
And
these are really interesting options. So I think your audience on Saturday is going to be very interested. Caitlin Doty will be speaking at the Game Changer Ideas Festival in Bismarck. She speaks at 4:15 in the afternoon. Her topic, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory. And if you want to find out more about the Game Changer Ideas Festival, that's GameChangerND.com. It's an all-day deal. And, of course, if you want to find out more about Caitlin Doty, go to that orderofthegooddeath.com. Caitlin, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, it's wonderful to talk to you. Thanks.
And our thanks to Humanities North Dakota for helping us set up that interview. Really excited to learn more about the Game Changer Ideas Festival. It's the kind of programming that is right in line with the mission of Prairie Public, which is to educate, involve, and inspire the people of the Prairie region. A guest like Caitlin just has this potential to make you realize, hey, there's a whole lot of stuff out there that I've never really thought about before, or, you know, maybe thought about in passing, and then you find someone who is brilliant and dedicated to this cause and just shining a light on what's going on and what she would like to do differently. Well, that's the kind of thing that we are looking for with you, the listener who calls in to become a member. It is also a direct line into our studios to share some of your ideas. We will ask you for comments that you'd like to share, and we print those out and we pass them around to everybody on staff. And I've gotten a lot of story ideas from people who have reached out either via the fund drives or just by sending an email. Our listeners are super smart and engaged and interested in a lot of things. And we love to hear from you, especially during these member drives, because it is your financial investment that makes everything that we do possible. And you can make that investment now when you call 1-800-359-4145. You can also click and join at prairiepublic.org or text the word support to 484848.
We have kind of an informal contract with our listeners here. We don't send out a bill. We make an appeal a couple of times a year. We remind you that the business model we live on is sort of this reciprocal relationship we have with the people who are listening to us. If they are interested and engaged and think we provide something of value, they send something of value back to us, which is, of course, financial support, which we deeply appreciate because that, of course, keeps this whole thing moving. This not quite perpetual motion machine, because, you know, if somebody stops giving, well, somebody else has to step up. And in our case, we have had other revenue streams trimmed by economic realities. Government has had to tighten its belt in North Dakota, and we were part of the belt tightening process. So that's why we go to our members, who are the most important piece of the pie in our budget expectations, and we say, look, we've lost it from here. We need a little more from you. That's what we're doing this year. We're asking our members to step up and dig a little deeper to keep Prairie Public as vibrant and as important as perhaps you think it is because you're listening. Give us a call, 1-800-359-4145, online at prairiepublic.org, or text the word support to 484848.
We love doing what we do here on Prairie Public, which is to do a lot of research on interesting people and topics and thought-provoking ideas, and to digest that information and put it out there into a form that we think is interesting and easy to understand and might help you stay a little bit more informed and engaged. We can only do that with your support now. You can text the word support to 484848. You can also click and join online at prairiepublic.org, or you can set up your membership or change your membership donation level with a simple phone call, 1-800-359-4145.
Joining us now on Main Street is Kelly Brown. She is the board president of the Association of Commerce in Wishick. And, of course, Wishick was going to have Sauerkraut Day today and did have Sauerkraut Day. But Kelly was a little complicated, right?
Yeah, it started out a little bit rough with the weather. I guess Mother Nature has her own attitude sometimes.
What is the weather like in Wishick today?
It is still snowing, actually. So we woke up to about 4 inches of snow, and then it got a little bit windy, and we're still snowing here now.
Well, this is the 93rd annual Sauerkraut Day. So how was the turnout affected by Mother Nature?
I was a little bit worried, I do got to say, but our most busy time for Sauerkraut Day typically is 11 to 12. Today it was 12 to 1. And so I feel like everybody still tried to make it. They just were a little bit later, and we still fed a lot of mouths, so that was really great.
Do you know roughly how many people came and how that compares to years past?
We were expecting quite a bit this year just because it is a political year, and that always brings our attendance up. We still did serve about 1,000 people, and that's not including the nursing home, the school, or the hospital.
Wow.
So it was still fairly high, not as high as some other years, but still, considering the weather, it's still considered a good success for sure.
So you didn't have to cut back on the sauerkraut and wieners?
We did not, actually, no. They kept asking, do you need more? Yes, we need more.
So, and there are no leftover pies?
I haven't even been over there. I couldn't tell you.
Well, there's some good hearty stock there in the sausage triangle. when you say political year, obviously we've got the midterms coming up. What is it about a political year that brings more people? Are there lots of people running for office who make an appearance at Sauerkraut Day?
Yes, when it is the political years, the political candidates typically do make an appearance here. We don't really let them talk on the microphone, but we give them about all 15 minutes, and they can say who they are, what they're running for, and basically a one-liner, and then they have to hand it off. So it's nice for them to be able to come here and shake people's hands and, meet face-to-face with some of the patrons who are voting for them.
Well, they were in Rutland for UFTA Days. They're in Wishick for Sauerkraut Day. Did they all show up?
We had a few show up. Not as many as we expected, but absolutely did. We had a good turnout still.
How many years, Kelly, have you personally been attending Sauerkraut Day?
Well, I was born and raised in Wishick, and I did move away for about 10 years, but I was still part of the Wishick band and choir that come to perform. And so they perform for about an hour, and I was part of that, actually. And so it's really fun to come back and see it come full circle. Now I'm the one working in the kitchen. So when I was a kid, I saw all that happening, and now I'm the one working back there and trying to keep the steady lines going. So I was born and raised here, moved away for about 10 years, but now I'm back, of course, and still participating in the community.
So the Wishick Public School Band and Choir performed under the direction of Janet Wolf, and the Bismarck Rockin' Cloggers showed up too?
Well, the cloggers called us this morning, and they said they couldn't make it because of the weather. So actually, Janet Wolf, she's an amazing, amazing woman, and I called her quite early this morning and said, could you perform for another hour, please? Oh, yeah, no problem. So she covered that hour, but she's one of the few people I can tell you that can get teenagers to sing in German and play accordion. So pretty impressive, actually.
Yeah, well, and clogs aren't really what you'd call appropriate winter shoes, so I don't really blame them for staying home. How many people does it take to put on Sauerkraut Day?
Well, it's sponsored by the Commerce, and we're a board of 10. But, I mean, honestly, with Sauerkraut Day, it is the full community. Everybody just seems to know their role, and you just hope that they come back. And we just know, you know, who's going to be starting the percolator for the coffee, who's going to make sure that there's enough rags. And everybody just has their role. Everybody does what they need to do. And I can tell you there's like at least 50, 100 people volunteering at any given time, whether it's the city workers or the business owners participating in the lines and the behind-the-scenes people truly who make this work.
Well, now, Wishik has a population of about what?
About 1,000.
That many people showed up, so either everybody in Wishik or lots of people outside of Wishik helped celebrate the Sauerkraut Day.
Yeah, that's true, yep.
Is the Wishik Civic Center, does it have a big kitchen? Is that where everything's made, or is it sort of around town?
No, it's nothing is made here, actually. It's a very small kitchen. It's part of the something with a historic, but we don't have a big enough facility. So actually, all of the kraut and wieners are made in huge pots, and they are at the city hall. And you stir them with a pitchfork. That's how large the pots are. And the potatoes are made. The school makes their own potatoes, and then the nursing home cooks and staff make most of the other ones. The hospital makes their own as well. But the nursing home makes all of the pots. And then we have what's called a krautmobile, and that's exactly what they do. They go over to the city hall, they go to the nursing home, they pick up the potatoes and the kraut, and they bring it to the city, to the civic center, where then we put it in smaller bowls for them to be dished out.
And then, of course, we've got those very bright pink wieners and the cheese to add a little color to the plate, right?
Yeah, the cheese has its history, I guess. We've always kind of wondered, why are we here? But I guess there's some history because Wishik used to be really big into dairy and the dairy farmers. That's how that all started with the cheese. But now it's tradition and you can't mess with that. So that's what we still do.
When you are serving that much sauerkraut, does it get to ever be sort of an assault on the nose or not so bad?
Hey, we're Germans down here. We're kind of used to that.
And those buildings have doors and windows, right?
They do, but it's pretty cold today, so we didn't open anything up. We go home and wash our clothes. That's a fact. I know you know when you're at sauerkraut days, you come home smelling a little differently, but it's all in fun.
Well, it's kind of cool that something's been going on for almost 100 years in a small town in south central North Dakota. So obviously this is important to people who live there.
It really is. It is really something that our community looks forward to. It's such a strong part of our past, and so everybody knows Wishik, and when you say Wishik, it's, oh, you're the sauerkraut capital of the world, and it's kind of self-proclaimed, but yeah, we'll take that.
Okay.
We use the influx of people for the businesses so that they can come in, and it's kind of a win-win situation, a free meal for everybody, but with the influx of people, we still hope that they go shop our community because there's a lot to offer here. We're very self-sufficient here.
Well, we are sad that we didn't end up making it. We're not apparently quite as hardy as you Wishik folks, but maybe Main Street can make it next year.
For the 94th annual Sauerkraut Day. We look forward to it. Kelly Brown, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for letting me talk to you guys.
Kelly is the board president of the Association of Commerce in Wishik, North Dakota.
Hi, I'm John Harris, President and CEO of Prairie Public. I'm taking this opportunity to ask you to become a Prairie Public member for the first time. Renew your membership or offer my thanks if you already have done so. If you have been on the fence and thought your contribution wouldn't be enough, let me say it is. Whatever fits within your budget is more than meaningful to Prairie Public. Counting you as a member also lets other stakeholders know that Prairie Public has a strong community support. Most of our operating resources come directly from listeners like you, but we do receive funding from the state of North Dakota. Our state budget was trimmed significantly during the last legislative session. While there's uncertainty regarding the next budget cycle, as Governor Burgum has asked all state agencies to trim their budgets again up to 10%. That includes Prairie Public. Further reductions in funding could impact Prairie Public's operation significantly. So, the reliance on listeners like you becomes even greater. Give us a call at 1-800-359-4145 or go to prairiepublic.org or text the word SUPPORT to 484848. Thank you for listening to Prairie Public, and thank you for your support.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 10th. North Dakota remembers World War I. On September 29th, 1917, throngs of people had stood amid garlands of red, white, and blue bunting, waving flags and banners as they crowded on the railroad platforms to send off Company B of the 1st Regiment of the North Dakota National Guard. Patriotic speeches and music filled the air. For the families, it had been a long, prayerful year. At first, the war news was hopeful, and only a spattering of local names were among the casualty lists. But as the American Expeditionary Force took on a more aggressive role, the ranks of the dead and wounded began to swell. On October 6, 1918, the citizens of Fargo and the surrounding towns were to gather in the Fargo Auditorium. A memorial had been arranged to pay tribute to the sacrifices of Company B and the other area men who had paid the supreme sacrifice. It was also a prayer service for those who were yet to meet their fate. With the war still raging, it would be a somber affair, with 28 names from Cass County on the list, including 11 names from Company B, dead or missing. 1,000 invitations were sent out to family members from Company B, but all area people were requested to join the event. It was considered a patriotic duty as well as a moral obligation to attend. As Fargo prepared to honor the one-year anniversary of the regiment's departure, the specter of death, which had hovered over the battlefields of France, had now found its way to the shores of America in the form of the Spanish flu epidemic. Carried home from Europe by returning soldiers, it had risen to such large proportions in the eastern United States that stamping it out had become an official part of the war effort. But death rode the rails westward, and by this date in 1918, over 200 cases of Spanish flu had been reported in Fargo alone. Spreading quickly across the state, flu deaths were also reported in New Rockford and Jamestown, and several Northern Pacific brakemen who had contracted the disease in the east had died in western North Dakota. The Company B Memorial and all public events were canceled. As difficult as it had been for families to cope with loved ones dying on the distant battlefields of France, death had now come to their own doorstep. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jim Davis. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hi, I'm Tom Ezern. I'd like to invite you to pick up my latest book, Pacing Dakota, for your $15 a month investment in Prairie Public. This book, Pacing Dakota, it's been a joy to me to travel around North Dakota, meeting the people who have been listening to Plains Folk on Prairie Public for years, and we've never laid eyes on one another, but now we have. Call 800-359-4145. Or go to prairiepublic.org or text the word SUPPORT to this number, 484848, and click on the link. Your support helps make programs like Main Street possible, not to mention the excellent news coverage Prairie Public delivers for the state of North Dakota. I hope you'll pick up the book, Pacing Dakota, and catch my Plains Folk essay every week on Main Street, and be generous in your support of Prairie Public this year and every year. Thank you.
Well, this is that part of the show where we say thanks for listening, but of course, I have to say a little more than that because we are in membership mode here at Prairie Public. So
we want to say thanks for supporting.
Yes, thanks for being a member. For those of you who are listeners who also have taken the next step to become members, thank you for, you know, helping us do the show, because that's what you're doing. You make Main Street possible with your contributions. So that's why we remind you a couple of times a year to, you know, If this number isn't burned into your brain, it is into ours. 1-800-359-4145. Online at PrairiePublic.org or text the word support to 484848. These are three different ways to do something that doesn't take much time but is vitally important to Main Street and to Prairie Public. That is member support of what we do.
And it's really easy to set up a sustaining membership. And what that is you take what you want to spend in an entire year and you break that down into monthly payments. It's kind of like if you ever have needed to buy a sofa on layaway, or you buy a car and you pay the loan payments or you pay lease payments. Well, that's pretty much how sustaining memberships work. You can just set a number. If it's $5 a month, that is a nice starting level to become a sustaining member of Prairie Public. And then it goes to work right away. And when we say it goes to work, we mean your financial investment helps us to purchase or produce everything that you hear on the air. A lot of shows are very expensive. Every year we spend $40,000 to bring you just Morning Edition. And then, of course, let's talk about the salaries of the people who work here and then the equipment that we need to do our jobs. It is an expensive operation, but we are here because we think it is vitally important to have an engaged and informed and entertained group of people. It's part of the human experience to have conversation. That's what we love. That's what we are here to do. And we thank you for your support because it is you who makes this all possible. 1-800-359-4145. Click and join at prairiepublic.org or text the word support to 484848.
And this is the next to the last day of our member drive. So this is a kind of an urgent reminder that if you haven't come on board, it is time. This is the last time you'll actually hear us make the appeal on Main Street.
Yep, we finish up after Morning Edition tomorrow.
So this is, it's getting to push comes to shove here, I guess, to make it as quick as possible. If you're listening, we need you to be a member. This is just the arrangement we have here. This is member-supported radio. We, as I always say, love our listeners. I like to be buttonholed on the street. I like somebody to say, you know, that was interesting what I heard yesterday. That's intriguing. You know, thanks for doing that. Well, thank you for listening, but boy, I want to embrace you if you're a member because you make it actually possible. And that's why it's important. This model doesn't work without you. Give us a call. 1-800-359-4145. Online at prairiepublic.org. You just go up to that home screen and there's a donate now at the upper right-hand corner. Click on that and it takes but a moment after that. Or if you got that smartphone, you just text the word support to 484848. For those of you who have done that this week, especially during Main Street, from Ashley and me, thank you very much. Well, tomorrow on Main Street, we're going to preview our episode this month of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life with host Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a professor of philosophy at UND. And this month, his guest is Professor Derek Black. They will explore the question, is there a right to education and literacy? Interesting topic. Sue Balcom will join us to talk about Apple. She's with the Root Cellar Farm near Mandan. And Ashley and I will have our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.